Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 14th of April. Joining us this hour is John Yoo. John Yoo, I'm sure many of you are familiar with. We're talking about his book and other issues. He's the author of Crisis in Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. He's a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley School of Law and a visiting scholar with the American Enterprise Institute. He did serve from 2001 to 2003 as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice, where he worked on issues involving foreign affairs, national security, and also the separation of powers. He, as you probably know, wrote memos that asserted that the president had the power to authorize the use of interrogation techniques at Guantanamo, and it was somewhat controversial. He feels perfectly free and comfortable, I believe. I'm not sure comfortable, but he will talk about all of that as well and the book. And he writes columns. You find him frequently writing opinion pieces for newspapers. We should have an extremely interesting conversation. This particular book, the Washington Post had an interesting review of the book, saying given Yoo's strong conservatism, it would be easy for liberals to dismiss Crisis and Command as one more venture in a hackneyed debate. But this is not true. The heart of this book is the highly favorable treatment that Yoo extends to five great presidents, all of whom should rank high on any liberal's list of admirable leaders: Washington, Jefferson, Jackson, Lincoln, and FDR, followed by a broad survey of the Cold War presidents from Truman through Reagan. This is a deeply serious history of the presidency. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org for you to join the conversation. John Yoo, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sure. The first part of the book you talk about, and I'm wondering where you stand on this, that there are members of the Supreme Court who take a strict – I've never understood what this meant – a strict constitutional view of issues, and others who believe in this living constitution, et cetera. It is used frequently in political debates. What does it mean? What does it mean to be a strict constitutionalist?
Well, I hope you don't misunderstand my description of it, but the underlying debate is this. Basically, there's several justices on the Supreme Court. I think here Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas are the leading proponents of the idea, which is that the Constitution's terms mean basically what they meant to those who adopted and ratified the Constitution back in 1788.
Mm-hmm.
The living constitution idea, which is really was most forcefully put forward by Justice William Brennan, was the idea that the words of the Constitution should be interpreted more in terms of their current everyday meanings. So, for example, just take sort of classic issue, abortion and the Due Process Clause. So, Roe versus Wade and Casey versus Planned Parenthood, these are cases where the Supreme Court has said that the 14th Amendment's guarantee of due process to all Americans protects the right of a woman to have an abortion. Justice Scalia and Thomas would say, well, the Due Process Clause back when it was ratified, no one would have thought that quote-unquote due process meant a right to have an abortion. I think people who are more on the living constitutional school would say, well, what does due process mean to us today? And that's, I think that's roughly, so it's a debate that's been going on in our courts for hundreds of years now.
Mm-hmm. The book traces the history of presidential power from the founding of the Republic up to the debates that we're having now and have had many of them during the time that you were with an administration, the war on terror. Was this a real difficult thing to figure out early on? Did George Washington have a difficult time figuring out what his power should be? Did he take guidance or did he create the power that he thought he should have?
Well, it's a good question based in light of what I just said, in that the Constitution doesn't speak specifically and enumerate lists a lot of times for things we would want to know the answers to. Sometimes it does use broad language or undefined language, and then constitutionalists or strict originalists have a hard time figuring out what to do. But even George Washington, who'd been head of the Constitutional Convention that wrote the Constitution and was the father of the country and the first president, the only president really unanimously elected through the Electoral College, even he had a hard time figuring out sometimes what the presidency's powers were, because there's a very short list, and then the major source of the president's power is just the vesting of the executive power of the United States in the president. So just give you one example of this. Very early on in his presidency, George Washington was going to negotiate the first treaty that under the Constitution with tribes on the western frontier, and so he saw that the Constitution said president makes treaties with the advice and consent of the Senate, that famous phrase, advice and consent. So he wrote up a list of questions and walked over to the Senate and actually went into the Senate while the Senate and asked them questions to take the advice of the Senate. He prompted hours of debates and questions and cross-examinations, and he was so frustrated he burst out of the room and was alleged to have said, "I'll be damned if I ever step foot in there again." And ever since then, no president has ever gone to the Senate in person or formally to ask for their advice for a treaty. And so President Washington actually set that precedent that, we see that with judicial appointments now. I'm sure we'll see it with Justice Stevens, the replacement for Justice Stevens.
Right.
The phrase advice and consent really now means that the Senate's really, it's their consent. You don't see presidents really taking their advice anymore. But that was really because of Washington and that incident in the very beginning of his presidency.
And who set a precedent when it came to conducting war?
Well, that of course is one of the most, if not the most, contested questions between presidents and congresses in the book. I think I talk about something that really has been overlooked by historians about this debate, which is our relations with the Indian tribes.
And yes.
That often when you read about this question, people skip or just overlook the wars with the Indians. But Indian tribes were one of the most severe security threats to the country in the very beginning. And people don't realize the Indians had a military that was just as large, if not larger, than ours at the time. In fact, in one of the battles in the first years of the Washington administration, wiped out most of our army in several battles. So Washington basically took the view that even though Congress had authorized him to defend the frontier, he basically took an army and launched an offensive against Indians in the West. And so ever since then you have examples like Jefferson and the Barbary Pirates, and then it gets more. You have more and more examples until you have Truman with the Korean War, and then so on, and probably can all list examples. But really, from the very beginning with Washington, there was already fighting over who got to direct war, who got to decide when the country would go to war.
What about Lincoln?
Lincoln is the most extraordinary of all the presidents, and sort of is the hero of the book and the central chapter of the book. And obviously, he took steps at the very beginning of the Civil War. They're probably the most expansive exercises of presidential power in our history. So to give you an example, right at the beginning of the Civil War, when secession came, Lincoln raised an army and navy. He took money out of the treasury. He sent that military into the South. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus. And then ultimately, I think his most important action, his greatest action, was one which was taken solely under his powers as commander-in-chief, which was the Emancipation Proclamation, freeing all the slaves. Supreme Court at the time had said that still the governing law was Dred Scott, which said that slaves were property and could not be freed by the federal state governments without just compensation to the owners. They were property. And Lincoln said, no, in the areas of the fighting, and this is why the Emancipation Proclamation didn't extend into the North, ironically, but he said, in the areas of the fighting where my commander-in-chief powers apply, I'm freeing the slaves. And so his greatest act was, I think, actually an exercise of what people today would call unilateral presidential power.
And was there debate about that, that people were saying, hey, Lincoln, you can't do this. It's not constitutionally given.
Oh, yes. There was enormous debate throughout Lincoln's presidency about all these steps he took. He was commonly called a dictator, or often by the South, of course, but even in the North. And it sort of culminated in the presidential election of 1864. His, if you think about challenges to sitting president, main challenger in the Democratic Party to Abraham Lincoln was General McClellan, who'd been his former general-in-chief, who accused Lincoln of being a dictator, of suppressing civil liberties, but also being incompetent, sort of a strange claim that Lincoln is both incompetent and a dictator at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, you know, he would restore the Constitution and he would seek a peace immediately with the South. So Lincoln, throughout his time in office, faced these accusations and attacks, I think going well beyond what we've seen in our own political system over the last 10 or 20 years.
So is it something that presidents define? Lincoln, of course, lived during exceptional times and maybe used exceptional power because of the exceptional times, whereas Harry Truman, who Korea is thought of as Truman's War, the times were not as exceptional, and he faced more and more criticism, or we tend to think that some went beyond the authority that they were given. We don't think that in terms of Lincoln, we do, or Washington. We do think that in terms of Lyndon Johnson, in terms of Richard Nixon, in terms of Harry Truman in Korea.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair point, and I try to, in this book, show how presidential power really is linked to what you just said, that we tend to think of our greatest presidents as presidents who were at the helm in times of great emergency. And sort of the view of presidential power I'm trying to portray here is that that's when the president's power expands, and that the president's power is supposed to be flexible. It's almost like an accordion. When you have these extraordinary circumstances, you have these great challenges to the country's security, the president's power is supposed to grow to meet it. The presidency is the only branch that's sort of always in existence that can react quickly and decisively, which is what the framers said about the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think you're quite right, when these periods don't exist, and that's most of the periods in our history are times of peace and where these extraordinary circumstances aren't present, then the president's power should retract and recede. And so what we should study, I think, and I try to in this book, is how do presidents properly react to these periods of emergency? When do some presidents who we have had in our history fail to meet the challenge? And then, for some of the examples you gave, like a Johnson or a Nixon, I would say, are people who tried to wield exceptional powers when there was no emergency.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, I think, when the latter two categories are really when we have examples of our worst presidents. There's also something I try to talk about in my book, too, is bad presidents.
And who were those? Who failed?
Well, I think actually the greatest example, and this is sort of the unanimous view of most historians, is that the worst president in our history was James Buchanan.
Buchanan. Mm-hmm.
Who was the president right before Lincoln. And what people don't realize, I think, is that Buchanan was one of our most distinguished people to become president. We don't realize that Buchanan thought that that secession was unconstitutional. He actually had the same view as Lincoln. But then Buchanan issued a legal opinion, actually, towards the end of his at the end of his presidency, while they were after Lincoln's election and they were waiting for the transfer of power. Buchanan actually said, "But I read the Constitution. I don't see that the president has any power to stop it. I just don't think the president can stop Southern states from leaving the Union, even though it's unconstitutional." And so, for that sort of narrow reading of his powers in the face of a great emergency, as historians think of him as, rate him as the worst president, Lincoln, as many people think, is our best. So Lincoln's constitutional view is 50% the same as Buchanan, but Lincoln also says, as president, as commander-in-chief and chief executive, I also have the power to stop the secession and to stop the destruction of the Union.
Mm-hmm. You served, of course, in the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department, where you wrote memos that, as you well know, have been somewhat controversial.
Yeah.
What about the Bush administration? What about their use of power? Were these, when you look at it historically, exceptional times, and this particular president used the exceptional times as an accelerant to do different things in the world?
I think it's a good question. One thing I try to say is that we won't know for some time whether it was the right matching of powers to circumstance. I can say right certainly at the time I was there, we thought it was extraordinary that the country was attacked in this manner on 9/11.
It was extraordinary, sure.
That was extraordinary, and I think what was even more extraordinary was the type of enemy. And this was an enemy that wasn't the nation that had attacked us. In fact, many nations in the world wouldn't have the ability to attack us that successfully with that kind of loss of life and destruction. So, certainly at the time we thought it was extraordinary circumstances, and I think we thought we were exercising powers that fell within what previous presidents had done when faced with emergencies too. But, you know, as I try, you know, I think I admit, and I try to say in the book, whether a president succeeds and whether it was appropriate depends on whether the circumstances justified the use of those powers, and presidents will fail if they try to exercise authorities, extraordinary authorities in wartime when there really wasn't a need for it.
Mm-hmm. So was there a precedent? Was there, when you were writing these memos and when you were, I mean, you're a historian, when you were writing these books, was there a time in history that guided you?
Oh, at the time where there, I mean, I think the other times when things like military courts, for example, or detention without habeas corpus of enemy combatants came up, these have come out before, but sporadically. So the Civil War, World War II were probably the most important precedents because those were cases where our legal system had encountered these questions. And I might add, had, I think, quite different views than the ones that our Supreme Court would eventually come to. But I think that, take for example, military commissions. It seemed extraordinary to many people. Late 2001, that President Bush proposed the use of these special military trials rather than civilian courts to try al-Qaeda members. But that was something that had been used during World War II by President Roosevelt and widely used by President Lincoln in the Civil War. But it's not something people had seen for 50 years, basically, or almost more than 50 years. And so I think it came as something of a surprise and a shock to people. But I think the same reasons that the government or presidents used them in those previous conflicts were the same ones that President Bush would use. The thing I do, the notion I do reject about the time I was in office anyway, was that the Bush administration used the 9/11 emergency as just an excuse to expand presidential power for its own sake. I really don't think so. I think that a lot of the measures, such as military courts, were things that had been used before in wartime. And I think really the argument is whether the circumstances justified using something like military courts.
Mm-hmm. And what about the circumstances justifying uses of torture techniques? Can you talk about that and also look at it from a historical perspective?
Well, you know, well, first of all, I don't think that the government really was engaging in torture. I think that the question that faced us was, at that time, who was thought to be the number three leader of al-Qaeda, and then, you know, eventually more people were captured who had been high-level participants in 9/11 or the al-Qaeda operation since then. And, you know, some of the interrogations led to the capture of those leaders later. And these were people for whom the security agencies said, look, reading this person, his Miranda warnings, and giving him a lawyer, sort of treating him in the normal civilian criminal justice system is just not going to produce intelligence, certainly not at the speed that we need it. People are extremely concerned. Remember, this is the spring of 2002, extremely concerned that there's going to be another attack. The question then is not, let's torture this guy. The question that was put to us in the Justice Department was, what can we do that goes beyond giving him warnings, Miranda warnings, and a lawyer, but doesn't cross the line into torture? What is that space in between there? What can we legally do to interrogate him?
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a hard question, and I recognize then and now that no matter what line we drew, someone was going to be very angry, and people are going to think we made the wrong decision. But we had to draw a line there, and it could have been, don't interrogate him at all. Just give him a lawyer and put him in the civilian justice system. I don't think that's what the law required. The law says you can't torture someone, but can you pressure that person? the thing that's extraordinary about it, and this goes back to your original question that we originally started talking about, was that's one of the things that made this so extraordinary. In a normal war, you wouldn't have to consider these kinds of issues, because when you fight a nation state, when you fight an enemy like Germany or Japan in World War II, this kind of information is not as critical. You know, you're fighting an enemy with a territory, and you know where their cities and population are located. But when you fight an enemy like Al-Qaeda, really the primary way you stop them is getting intelligence from them about their plans.
How do you determine that space, though? I mean, that's a big thing to do. Did you look at Washington and Lincoln and FDR and Jackson and all these people, or did you look at treaties? What did you look at?
I would be the last person to say this is an easy question. I think it's a really difficult question, and I always find people on either side who say, "Oh, this is straightforward, and this is what I would do." Who have an immediate answer top of their heads, I think, I always am dubious about people who have that quick a response and easy answers to these kinds of questions. The 9/11 attacks forced us to have to, consider all kinds of issues that we just never faced before because of the nature of the enemy. But because of that, we did look at all kinds of things. I mean, we looked at other American laws. We looked at the rare cases where this issue has come up in American cases. Other countries, we looked at other, like what Britain and Israel had done. They had faced similar problems, and in fact, in the end, had proved similar interrogation methods to the ones that the United States would use. We looked at articles by scholars. We looked at history. As you said, we looked at the presidential powers exercised by previous presidents and other conflicts. And so we tried to look at everything we could think of. And as you say, I know the analyses are controversial, and they're heavily criticized by people. But I think one thing I always ask is, well, what opinion would you have had instead? You know, as you said, this is a very difficult question, and most people it's very easy to criticize, but what kind of legal opinion would someone else have given? You know, what would you have actually written out, in your view, in this time, just the first few months after the 9/11 attacks?
We're going to welcome phone calls. John Yoo is our guest this hour, and his latest book, he's written several books, is Crisis and Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. He's also the author of The Powers of War and Peace, Foreign Affairs and the Constitution After 9/11, and War by Other Means, An Insider's Account of the War on Terror. He's teaching law now at the University of California at Berkeley. He's a visiting scholar with the American Enterprise Institute, and from 2001 to 2003, he served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice. 800-486-8655 is our number. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Scott from La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen. I told Chrissy when I called in, I hope this is not too esoteric, but it's a question I really have wondered about, which is this, that when the revolutionaries wrote the Declaration of Independence, they single out King George III, and they say, you know, his tyranny's done this, and he's done this, and he's done that, and he's done all this thing, and this is how we've suffered. And therefore, you assume that because they are then going to have a revolt, break away from the tyranny of this king, they are going to be very, very circumspect in how they set up a government in relation to watching out for a president that would have all these powers and a Congress to keep that in check. But if you look at the history of England, it seems to me that what happens is by the time George III is king, it's way past the Glorious Revolution, and in fact, it's a constitutional monarchy. In other words, what I'm saying here is this king is really not the entity that's oppressing the poor colonists. It's really another legislative body. So the question I've got is, how really afraid of a president were they at the time? How, you know, in that context, shouldn't they really be addressing the Declaration of Independence to the Parliament in England instead of George III?
This is a really good question. This is not an esoteric question, and in many ways, this is one of the fundamental debates about the nature of presidential power in the American Constitution. Because there is this, what people think of as a tension between the Revolution and the Constitution. The Revolution, as you say, in the Declaration of Independence, produces what's often seen to be an anti-executive document. And people often say, how could our American presidents have any broad powers at all, given that we rebelled against King George III for his, many oppressions in the Constitution? One point to make, as you rightly point out, is that what the framers really were rebelling against was what was the excessive powers exercised by Parliament over what they thought were the colony's traditional rights under the English Constitution, because it was really Parliament that was passing the laws, imposing the taxes that gave rise to tea parties and things like that. The 1776 versions of tea parties. Anyway, but the second point is, and this is, I think, takes your story a little farther, is that it is true that after the break from England, that Americans were very leery of executive power. They did think of the Revolution as also being against King George III, at least symbolically. And they wrote, if you look at the state constitutions of the time, they are very pro-legislative and anti-executive. For example, Pennsylvania had a executive branch which was made up of 12 people that were appointed by the legislature who only held office for 1 year and couldn't be reelected. And that shows you how extreme the reaction to executive power was. But then these state constitutions were seen to be failures. And the reason the framers got together in Philadelphia in 1787 and wrote the Constitution was seen as a reaction against what had gone too far in the states. And that's why you have, I think, an executive branch and a presidency that is more unified, that has more powers than people would expect. And this is something I think Gordon Wood, who's probably the most respected historian of the founding period. This is really a sort of thesis that he really developed first in his book, The Creation of the American Republic, which I highly recommend if you want to delve into this, I think by no means esoteric question, farther. But you can still see the debates we're having today about presidential power and the relation of the president and Congress is really a fight about the ideals of the Revolution and what you see in the Declaration of Independence and what you see in the Constitution.
Thank you, Scott, so much for your call. Let's go to Ray from Milwaukee next. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Ray.
And to your guest. By the way, George Washington, during the War of Independence, when the Hessian mercenaries were fighting on behalf of the British, they were very brutal to our boys when they would capture the Patriots fighting here. And by the way, we didn't have uniforms, and we refused to march in line, and thereby the British called us terrorists for not wearing uniforms. But when George Washington's troops caught the Hessian mercenaries, who had been extremely brutal to our people, Washington refused to allow them to be treated harshly. And after a year or so of them being held by our people, they were so comfortable amongst us, we didn't have to use as many guards to guard them. And we did not treat them harshly. There was no reason to treat another human less than a human. And my question to you, Mr. Yu, is if you saw your neighbor waterboarding a neighbor dog, would you call the police or would you just say, well, he's not killing the dog, he's just punishing the dog?
I'm sorry to say that I think that this question really doesn't in any way represent the kind of choices that we were making in the government. First of all, the reason Washington gives that order is because he wants there to be reciprocal treatment for our troops. And first of all, it's not true that American troops are all fighting out of uniform and out of order. I mean, General Washington actually goes a long way to having the American Army at the time fighting in uniform, using what were considered the sort of methods of organization at the time. And Washington, what he does is very important to make sure that the American military and the British military fight along the civilized rules of warfare. Washington doesn't want enemy soldiers mistreated out of some sense of revenge or vengeance. And I have to say that is not the reason. You know, the Bush administration was not pursuing these interrogation methods, which were used on a very small number of people compared to the numbers that were detained by our military and the CIA during this war. It wasn't out of some sense of punishment or any sense of vengeance. I'm afraid the problem was that in order to fight this war, intelligence is far more important because of the covert nature and the non-state nature of the enemy. And the only or primary way to get that information was from these al-Qaeda leaders. So I don't think that comparing it to, you know, neighbor, you know, abusing as a dog, or Washington, you know, ordering the humane treatment of Hessians is really the same kind of problem that the Bush administration was facing. Second point I'll just make is, you know, for the great majority of people captured, aside from these al-Qaeda leaders, they were treated very well. You know, people who visited the Guantanamo Bay base have said that it's a very good facility. This is both Bush administration officials and Obama administration officials. For many of these people captured, this is the first time that they ever received Western levels of medical care. And so I just reject the notion that the Bush administration or the United States today is treating these detainees in an inhumane manner.
Obviously, when you're examining, which is a tall order, what that space that you talked about is going to be, you have to look in terms, and you're informed by history, and you are a historian. So one of the questions that you would have to ask is, what techniques can we use with the ultimate result being that we're going to get valuable information?
Right. Now, this is where you sort of leave the realm of what lawyers do, and then you have to rely more on what people who are interrogators, people who work for the FBI and the CIA think after studying this issue. And they believed at the time that, there was this imperative to get information and quickly, because, you know, again, you know, I'm not saying that these kinds of methods are always appropriate at all times. I think the one thing goes back to, you know, what we're talking about at the very beginning of our talk together is the circumstances. And we were in a set of circumstances less than a year after 9/11. And people thought there was going to be, almost everyone thought there was going to, in and out of government who studied this issue, thought there's going to be a second attack on the United States. And so the issue is, how much pressure do you want to use given the need for that information and the certainty of the identities of the people that you're holding? You know, the fact that they're al-Qaeda leaders, you know, people who we thought had in their heads the plans for ongoing attacks on the United States. And so that's, you know, fortunately, you know, people, you know, different parts of the government give their best advice, and then those issues rise up to people, you know, the cabinet level officers, and then ultimately the president, who have to weigh all those things together. But under those circumstances, I find it, for example, very hard to think that a President Gore would have made a different decision.
Mm-hmm. Hey, let me just go ahead for a moment here, and then we'll go back to phone calls, I promise you, everybody. And we have a couple lines open, 800-486-8655. You wrote it, we're dealing with a whole new presidency now and a historic event in terms of, talk about history, this one will be written about in years to come. You wrote a recent piece in the Wall Street Journal, which I found interesting, Professor Yu, saying that Barack Obama may not realize it, but I may have just helped save his presidency by winning a drawn-out fight to protect his powers as commander-in-chief to wage war and keep Americans safe. Tell me more what you meant by that. How did you save his presidency?
Well, you have to recognize, of course, there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek
there. Of course,
there.
Of course.
But, you know, one thing is, I think when we go through the list of who the great presidents are, you know, as I do in the book, and as we love to do as Americans, we love to rate things and rank our presidents and so on. The greatest ones were presidents, as I said, who, you know, interpreted their powers fairly broadly, sometimes or oftentimes in conflict with the other branches, to rise to the challenge of these serious threats to the country. And so I think that President Obama faces some very serious threats to the country, the Iraq War, the Afghanistan War, and then war on terrorism. And I think their ultimate, how they do in history, how we judge them later, say 20 years from now, how we judge Obama, I think will have a lot to do, if not all to do, with how he faces those threats. And so one thing I thought and continue to think is that in order for Obama to succeed, he has to rely on a broad vision of the presidency, a broad view of his powers along the lines of his greatest predecessors. And so the last thing I think he should do is, which I sometimes think is the view of the critics of presidential powers, that he should become something more like a prime minister and look to Congress to set policy and look to Congress to lead the country in the face of these national security threats. So I think of myself as protecting or promoting the presidency so that Barack Obama can use it effectively.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to more phone calls. Mike from Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. A comment kind of in response to one of the previous callers, talking about this waterboarding situation. I fully comprehend the context of time because, I mean, he's comparing the Revolutionary War era with the current era in the sense that, well, okay, in the Revolutionary War, the threat was a musket, and today the threat is potentially an atomic bomb in the hands of a terrorist. So, yes, you have to move very quickly, without a doubt. And, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking is very easy. But going back to my question is, from a historical perspective and looking over a long period of time, presidencies lurch either to the right or to the left. Some are centrist. But in this lurch back and forth and from the perspective of foreign policy, is it good for the United States or would something more consistent and in line be better? And look at the stark difference, or maybe there isn't that much difference between, let's say, the Bush administration and the Obama administration with regards to foreign policy.
It's a super question. First, thanks for raising a point that I didn't get to, which is that when we think about the current circumstances and the threat to the country, we should think about the magnitude of the threat, not just the possibility of it. And I think sometimes when we talk about terrorism and events after 9/11, we focus too much on the probability or the possibility that another attack will succeed. And sometimes I think we forget the magnitude of the harm. I mean, you look at 9/11 itself and the number of people that were involved, the amount of resources that it cost Al-Qaeda to carry off the attacks was, think about, very small, far less than an individual, tank or airplane would cost the United States to build, and look at the devastation that they caused. And these were not using any kinds of weapons of mass destruction, which the president said yesterday we all know Al-Qaeda is trying to get a hold of. Thank you very much for that point. I think that's a really important issue. I missed the question, I'm afraid. What was the question?
Do you want me to re-ask it?
Yeah, just because I was so busy thinking about what you said first and wanted to make sure I focused on that. What was your question again? I'm
okay, the question was over, let's say, a long period of time, let's say the last 100 years.
Yes.
But when you look at the power of the presidency, some presidents lurch to the right, others to the left, and I'm talking in the context of foreign policy here, and some are centrist. So over the long period of time, what is better for the United States, these lurches to the left or to the right or the centrist ones, or would something more consistent be better? And I guess you could draw it to the contrast between the Bush administration and the Obama administration. And on one hand, you could say there's stark differences. On the other hand, maybe not so much. In the long run, what is better for us?
Oh, that's a great question, and it's a very complicated one. The interesting thing, one observation I'd make is that many scholars, I think, in political science in particular, think that actually our system is much more stable and less given to lurches than Europe, for example. If you think of a parliamentary system of government, which most of the other Western democracies have, if you have an election like the one we just had in 2008, where the same party, where basically the same people are the charge of the party in parliament and are the chief officers of the cabinet, then you win an election and you can really move the political system. I mean, under parliamentary system, there really would not have been any problem for President Obama, for example, and the Democratic Party to get health care through. They would have done it a lot faster than here. So actually, the American system, compared to other countries, is seen as a relatively slow-moving system where it takes several elections, actually, for things to move in a certain direction. And, of course, that's one of the criticisms about health care and President Obama is that he's been trying to move the country too fast as a result of just one election. So actually, I don't think of the American system as lurching left and right too quickly. The second thing is that when presidents have, at least in the examples I've looked at, have really expanded their powers, it really hasn't been to promote an agenda to the left or to the right. I really think when you look at people like, well, certainly Washington, but then you look at someone like Jackson or Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt or several of our Cold War presidents who were all obviously leaders of parties and had agenda, you know, political agendas. But when it came to these expansive readings of their presidential powers, particularly in the area of war and national security, it was usually to respond to threats, and they were being pragmatic. They were trying to react quickly and swiftly to stop these threats, and it wasn't really with a rightward or a leftward shift.
You know, I'm thinking, as you're saying that, that they were really leading a country. They were leading a country, and people, I'm sure, responded that way. When you think of FDR, it's hard to think of right and left. People were responding to war.
Yeah. Although the interesting thing is, one thing I did uncover is now, there's sort of a tragic quality to it in this sense, that when presidents do these things, when they make these claims of power, they know that the political system is going to react in a negative way, that the other political party is going to criticize them for the use of their powers. And they still do it, even though they know it's going to harm them politically, in fact. So Washington, for example, you originally asked me about Washington and what he did to set some of the precedents for the power of the executive branch for the future. One thing he did at the beginning of the French Revolution was decide that it was going to be the president who was going to set foreign policy. The Constitution doesn't actually say who gets to decide whether the United States is going to be friendly or mean to another country. And so when the French Revolution started, people on both sides said, let's defend France or let's ally with Great Britain. And Washington ultimately decided, I think quite rightly, to be neutral. But he had to claim that the president's just power, his power just as chief executive of the country, gave him the authority to just set that policy. And he was viciously attacked for this. In fact, he prompted the creation, that decision prompted the creation of partisan political parties. The Democratic Party really formed as a response to what the founders of the party, Jefferson and Madison, thought of as Washington's excessive claim of presidential power.
Hmm.
Think about it, the father of the country, you know, the guy who really was most...
You don't think of him that way.
Yeah,
right.
Of independence for our country. They were calling him a British spy and a secret monarchist and things incredible. Really incredible. But the presidents know that at times when they have to take these steps. And they still go ahead and do it because, as you said, they're trying to lead the nation rather than, you know, pull the country to the left or to the right.
John Yoo, our guest, Crisis in Command, his latest book, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. Returning to phone calls, William from Colfax is next. Hi, William.
Hi. I had a comment and then a question. It seems like to me that the right or conservative movement in this country is always criticizing judicial appointments for judicial activism and not a strict interpretation of the Constitution and not respecting the Constitution. And I was thinking that it seems like the Bush administration and you yourself have used the Constitution sort of as a as a document of convenience, because I think in the form of the Patriot Act, you eliminated the Fourth Amendment, and I think for that reason alone, I think that was a mistake to eliminate the Fourth Amendment. It's a very important amendment to the Constitution of the United States, and I think it was. I think that Al Qaeda, instead of being elevated to the status of a foreign nation, should have been treated as a international criminal organization. And I think we would have gotten much more international support for that than, you know, going the way that we did now, where we're at war without end with an enemy that has no country.
Professor Yoo.
I didn't see a question. I didn't hear a question, so I'll just comment on that comment. So, first is, I think that as a matter of strategy, it seems to me that pursuing a sort of law enforcement method just had failed in response to al-Qaeda. That was the view of terrorism that was, and this is not a partisan issue, that was a view of terrorism that was held by every administration of both political parties for many decades before the 9/11 attacks. And I think what the 9/11 attacks showed was that the abilities of al-Qaeda and the kind of harm they inflicted on the country on 9/11 were just outside the abilities of the law enforcement system to handle. If we were still within the, thinking of it as a international criminal conspiracy, then I think al-Qaeda would still be in charge in Afghanistan today. I mean, we wouldn't be able to go into Afghanistan and use military force to try to root them out and disrupt them, which I think, despite the costs of the war there, have been successful. I think the ISIS has been successful in really harming al-Qaeda and keeping it unable to really focus on launching another 9/11. I mean, they're still trying, but I think we've been successful in preventing them from doing so for that. Second, I don't think that the Bush administration should be thought of as using, I think you said, viewing the Constitution as, I think you said, as a document of convenience. I mean, one is, the Constitution obviously sets out limits to power. It obviously recognizes the individual liberties of the citizens of our country, but it also does empower the government to protect itself and protect the country and ultimately protect all of us from foreign attack. I mean, that, I think, is one of its most important functions. The Patriot Act is, it's not some kind of unilateral directive that was issued by President Bush. I mean, the Patriot Act was passed by Congress, Congress with Republicans and Democrats, and it had, it was passed by enormous majorities of both parties. So, I don't think it's just a Bush administration thing. But secondly, I think whether, the Patriot Act and how consistent it is with the Fourth Amendment is a hard legal question. Again, and this goes back to, one of the first questions we talked about, on this conversation, which was how unusual were the 9/11 attacks, how extraordinary were the circumstances. Unfortunately, the reason why we need something like the Patriot Act is because we have an enemy that acts covertly and tries to succeed by infiltrating into the United States and by concealing what they do as if it were innocent civilian activity. So they use the internet and they use email and they use cell phones to communicate with each other. In that respect, it's very different than fighting, say, Germany, Japan, and World War II. And so unfortunately, because of that, if we want to try to catch them, I think, especially when they're closest to their targets, when they get inside the country, I think the government, I think, quite naturally wants to try to catch them, but consistent with the Constitution. So the Patriot Act, a lot of the things in the Patriot Act, if you look closely at it, were powers that courts had already upheld when they had been applied against drug cartels or organized crime, but were used in a broader way against al-Qaeda, against terrorists.
Thanks, Willem, for the call. Connie is next from Arcadia. Hi, Connie.
Hi. I'm not sure if this question is germane or not, but when I think about using torture to our country using torture on people, my understanding is that you don't get good information that way anyway. And it feels to me like we're stooping and becoming the evil that we deplore when we do that.
We have about a minute left. John, you?
Well, Kathleen raised a question, too. I think the first point in response is that certainly a lot of people in our government who are experts in intelligence think it works. And I think the information that we're starting to finally see come out from the government shows that enormous amounts of intelligence. In fact, the great majority, if not most, of the information we had on al-Qaeda in the first few years after the 9/11 attacks came solely from these interrogations. So I think that's one. The second point is, this question of stooping to the level of the enemy, I mean, that's I think, just too broad a principle to really help us figure out how to fight al-Qaeda or not. I mean, you could say the same thing about just using violence, about shooting them, about fighting a war against them. You could say, well, they've attacked us, we're academic. You could say the same thing about the use of predator drones now. You could say, well, we're stooping to their level by shooting missiles at them because they tried to, blow up targets in the United States, and we're shooting missiles behind the lines over there. I don't think that that kind of approach really helps one figure out what the steps are that we need to take to prevent another 9/11 attack today.
John Yoo, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Oh, thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. John Yoo, the book is Crisis and Command, A History of Executive Power from George Washington to George W. Bush. He's a professor of law now at the University of California at Berkeley and a visiting scholar with the American Enterprise Institute. He did serve as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Counsel of the U.S. Department of Justice, working on foreign affairs, national security, the separation of powers, and is, as you know, very well known and somewhat controversial for writing the legal briefs, many of them on which the Bush administration relied, including treatment of detainees at Guantanamo Bay. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production of this hour as well. We'll be with you again tomorrow. Great conversation ahead.